My name's James Lindsay. I am a test strategist, and I've been here before to talk about things like negative testing, exposure testing, session-based testing, data and testing. It's very nice of me finally to be talking about an area that I have at least somewhere in my job title as a piece of my expertise. I am a test strategist. I'll clear up a couple of things first. First off, you'll notice that the slides in your CDs have got very few words on them. That's so that you can write into your notebooks. You'll also notice that you have no notebooks, so my apologies for taking up your CDs with large amounts of blank space in the slides. Second thing is calls. Call from the office, call of the wild, call of nature, all of them outside, please. If your phone goes off in here, I'd love to answer it. Last time I was in here, the phone on the wall over there went off. So that was good. Test Strategist Toolbox. I'm a test strategist. What does that mean? It's not a common title. You don't see it in that many job descriptions. As a test strategist, I help people work out what they're going to plan in software testing and how they're going to plan it. And this involves a whole set of skills, a whole set of different ideas within software testing that spread a bit outside too. And I thought that with this presentation, I would hope to bring you into that kind of world. I see a lot of test strategies. I write a lot of test strategies. I get asked to come in and assess test strategies. I get asked to come in and assess how testing is going against its strategy. And a lot of times there's a lot of misunderstanding about what a test strategy is, what it could be. So I'd like to start off with, with a brief exercise. I think that if we're a large group, we all need to play as a group together. It's the end of the Thursday, and I'm going to play the soulmate game. Anybody here aware of the soulmate game? I'm pleased that nobody here is aware of the soulmate game because it means nobody's been to one of these presentations before because I made it up. I'd like you, please, to take out the green slip on your chair, flip it over, and write a two-digit number on the back of it. A two-digit number. I do not mean pi times e. Two-digit number, somewhere between 0 and 99. Assuming your 0's got two 0's in. Please write down a two-digit number. Now I'm going to tell you the rules of the game. The rules of the soulmate game are that in this room is your soulmate. Lucky you. You get to find your soulmate here and now, today. Your soulmate has just written on the back of their green slip the same number that you've just written on the back of your green slip. They're your soulmate. It's good to find them. So I'd just like you to think for a moment about how you're going to go about finding your soulmate in this room full of people. Room full of people. Some of you have got the same numbers on the back of your cards. How do you find your soulmate? Does anybody want to give me an answer? How are you going to find your soulmate, sir?
Stand up and yell the number.
Stand up and yell the number. It's an excellent way forward. Has anybody got a different method for finding their soulmate? Yes, ma'am. Order them up. Get them, arrange everybody. Get them all to stand together. Anybody over this side, concentrating really hard? Anybody got another way of finding their soulmate in the room? Get up, walk around. So you're going to shout, you're going to walk around, you're going to take control. Write it down, stick it over your head. Anybody else? Yes! Entirely new one from Keith. Put it up on Jambo. Any others? Lots of different ways forward. Lots of different approaches. I'm not saying that any one of those is a strategy. But I think there are some underlying strategies that come out. Clearly one of those underlying strategies is about communication.
One thing I should remember about communication is not stand too close to that microphone, because it hums.
So we've got a strategy for communication. That didn't work for your method, did it? You've got a method that arranges people. There's an organisational strategy. There's a strategy of getting people to work together. The great thing about your strategy is that probably everybody would find their soulmate at the same time. You arrange people in order, they're going to be standing next to their soulmate. Anybody got another method? The Australians came up with this method immediately. Most of them decided this was the right method for them. Anybody want to hazard a guess? Right at the back. You can learn from experience. There are lots of different ways forward. The one that I'm looking for is a number of Australians decide to sit down. And they decide to sit down and wait until everybody else has been found. That made their life so much easier for finding their soulmate. It's fun to stand on stage and run a dating agency for testers. That's something that I personally enjoy. But I hope that that gives you an idea that there are different strategies. That would be a strategy of exploiting the situation, organising groups, communication. You can mix and match those. But by looking at the different tactics people take, you can come up with an idea of what's going on in terms of their strategic approach. Let me give you a brief map of where we're going today. I'm going to start talking about test strategy. I'll first off talk about strategy, then I'll talk a little bit about testing. Then I'm going to get on to the interesting bit, the toolbox. Within that toolbox, we'll talk particularly about how you discover things you need for a strategy, how you perform analysis on that, and how you go through a process of synthesis to get a strategy out the other end of it. I think the models are very important to that, and we'll be coming back and forth with models throughout this. So let's look at strategy. Oh, lots of red squares. Moving on. There we are. I've got a very slow laptop today. It's the Florida weather. Never mind. Strategy is a guiding vision. I'm going to exploit the situation. I'm going to organise people. I'm going to communicate what I've got. That gives you ideas of how you're going to plan, of the decisions you're going to take. It gives you a shape in which to work. Very often, as testers, as test managers, we've got a hard job to do in a restricted amount of time. The higher up the food chain of management you go, the more times you've got to manage demands on you that really can't both be met. They're exclusive, conflicting demands. If you're doing that, you need a strategy. If you're doing that, you need some kind of decision-making framework. Indeed, if you're making those kind of decisions, you have a strategy. A strategy is unique. Strategy tends to go with a project. Sometimes it goes with an individual. A misapplied strategy, using a strategy after the situation has changed beyond all doubt, or using one strategy from one project in another, is a route to failure. Typically, you'll find a strategy is unique. It's characteristic as well. It contains the values of a project. People understand a project, they understand how they're working because of the values they're working towards. That is their strategy. It's unique and it's characteristic. On great projects, it's also shared. Shareable and shared. Something that can be talked about. Something where you can move that information around. Everybody can start making decisions in the same way. And it is actually used in that way. So that's what a strategy is to me. It's a guiding vision. Sometimes people use the word strategic. Now, strategy and words like strategic are horribly misused. They tend to mean, in many contexts, expensive. Or long-term. Or, in some cases that I've been involved with, put off. For now. That's what strategic can mean. I prefer to take a more positive approach to something that's strategic. If there is something that is strategic, a strategic decision, a strategic strength, tool, characteristic, artifact, it allows you to take opportunities which otherwise would be impossible to get hold of. That's what something that is strategic allows you to do. A test strategy
is a strategic thing. I think that strategies are also driving. Don't necessarily, they say how you might react out of a set of different decisions, but they drive you towards certain courses of action. They drive you towards certain decisions. They're not basically reactive. So that's strategy, and that applies to a great many things. We've all come across marketing strategies. Some people have read Sun Tzu and have come across strategies for war. There are strategies for business. There are strategies for playing games. We're not talking about any of those. We're talking about testing strategies. And what makes testing so very special when it comes to strategy? Did somebody just turn up one day and say, I need a bigger word than this. I need a bigger word than testing plan. It's not enough for me a testing manager. I'm going to be a test strategist and I'm going to write test strategies. Well, perhaps they did. Perhaps it is a bit of a misnomer. Personally, I think not. Although testing is a service, it is strategic. It gives out information that otherwise can't be obtained in timescales you otherwise can't get hold of. It opens up opportunities that are otherwise impossible to get to. That's what testing does. Testing is strategic. It gives you information about your project, information about your product that allows you to move forwards, take on the opportunities. And testing is also a service. And services aren't always strategic. But I put this together really to, I hope, refine this in your mind. With testing, you may well finish what you've got to do. Without testing, you might not finish what you've got to do. It's a service. You don't necessarily need testing to complete development. You need testing to make a product. You need testing to make value. Testing opens up the value in your product. That's why testing is strategic. So I believe testing is special. Testing is strategic. It's a strategic decision for companies. When I've been involved with companies as a test strategist, sometimes I've been involved on the technical side, sometimes I've been involved on the commercial side. The commercial side certainly see testing as a strategic set of questions. A strategic set of information comes out of that. It allows them to take decisions and make particular opportunities happen, otherwise they would not be able to do that. One of the reasons testing is strategic is because it's difficult. You don't know when you've finished. You don't know how much you're going to spend on testing. And I think that we've all heard that. We've all heard different ways of planning it. Be able to control that spend, to be able to understand it, but we know that we really don't know when we're complete. It's not a process of construction. It's also highly constrained. It's constrained by time, constrained by resource. You may not be able to do everything you want to do. You're going to have to start taking some decisions. So is a test strategy important? Yes, it is. Is testing important? Yes, it is. Testing changes things. Strategies allow you to make decisions. Within change, you're going to need a test strategy. You're going to need to share that vision. You're going to need to balance the demands that are placed upon you. And as things change, you're going to need to stay focused against those time pressures and against those constraints. And a strategy can help you do that. It can help you modify what you're doing in a way that stays within that vision of what you're trying to do, rather than simply react to what's going on around you. So enough spiel on testing and test strategy. Let's talk about the toolbox. A test strategist's toolbox is full of different techniques, different methods to arrive at some kind of a strategy. And there's all sorts of things I can do within that about decisions and about analysis, looking for what's going on. And I hope that within this, you'll get an idea of some of the things that I do. You'll get an idea of some of the things that some of my colleagues do when I've talked with them. I hope that you'll have an idea about what you do as strategists within your own organisations. And we'll also look at some of what gets recommended. It's important, though, to me that we start thinking of models. We start thinking of the way that models work within our strategies. I don't believe that you can template a strategy because it's unique and because it's characteristic. But I believe there are models out there of strategy. So we're going to play another game. And this is a game about decisions. And I have to say, I was expecting a slightly different room shape, but this will do. We're going to play a game that could be called 1, 2, 3, 4. But I'm not going to call it that. I'm going to call it John, Paul, George, and Ringo. You guys here, you are John. Can everybody who's John stick their hand up? That's it. Now, too far back. Man in the green shirt, you're the last John that far back in the room. Guys behind you, you are George. John, Paul. You are Paul. So, Paul, can you put your hand up? Various Pauls. Everybody, okay, we've got people who kind of think they're Paul, kind of think they're not. You know, there was some terrible things that normal people thought they were the Beatles. Never mind. So, John, Paul, George. Plenty of Georges in the room. At the back. Yes, that's it. Perfect. John and Ringo. Anybody happy to be a Ringo?
Yeah.
John, Paul, George, and Ringo. That's what we're going to call this game. I'm going to give each of you a model. And I'll describe this model to you. John, when you do decisions, you're going to think of the best way that you can do things. Your keyword is good. Paul, when you think of things, you're going to do things fast. George, you're cheap. George, you're going to think of how to do things cheaply. Ringo, you don't want to get blamed for anything. So, John, Paul, George, and Ringo. Good. Good, fast, cheap, and safe, perhaps. Blameless. Who knows? Now, I'm going to give you a task. I had a couple of tasks here. We had a testing task and a not-so-testing task. I'll start off with a not-so-testing task. I would like you to go through the following steps. Firstly, the problem I'm going to set you in these individual groups of four, the problem I'm going to set you is, you need to go and buy a present for your spouse's mother. It's not necessarily a straightforward problem. And you've got these different ways of doing it. You've got good, fast, cheap, blameless. It'd be nice to Ringo. Now what I'd like you to do, and how I'd like you to do this, is I'd like you to please turn to the person next to you and smile at them. I'm checking. Turn and smile. Now, please turn the other way and smile at somebody else within your group. Catch their eye. Smile. Lovely. Everybody smile at Dave. I'd like you to talk with that person you smiled with for 90 seconds. Perhaps less than that. I'd like you to talk with that person for just a minute. These are testers, after all. Talk with that person for just a minute about how you're going to buy a present for your mother-in-law. About 30 seconds left. I think we're about there. It's taken about a minute.
I hope that some of you have made a good friend in the room. That is, after all, what coming to these conferences are about. I'm going to start with Paul. Does anyone of the Pauls? Yes, sir, at the back. You're going to have to shout from back there because I haven't got a roving microphone. Yay! Now, is that fast or cheap? Cheap. These guys. Yes, that'll do. How about good?
Interview the spouse.
Interview the spouse. Sorry, it just frightens me, the idea of interviewing my spouse. Anyone else? I like that idea. Yes, so you're going to make some inquiries, find out some stuff. That's going to be good. You're going to end up with a good present. You guys, you're going to end up with them. Yes. John says that you're not going to end up with anything. George! Anybody else on George's side? How pleasant. Man with the bag there. Yeah, give your spouse's mother test tools. That's lovely. I've got any number of t-shirts my mother wears for painting. I'm sure I can give some to my girlfriend's mother. That'd be great. Right. And Ringo.
Send the wife shopping, have a pretty money.
Hey. Yes, you can have
it's safe.
So in the first instance we started with some ideas of what approaches you might take and got to an idea of strategy. Now we started with a single word, strategy. We've come up with different approaches to a difficult problem. Not necessarily that one is better or worse than any others, but that there are different approaches to the one problem, and that those different approaches are dictated to you by the context in which you're in. We also saw that there are plenty of different good ideas within the same basic strategy. So I wanted to mention models. Mention models. There we are. I wanted to mention models. I think that as you put a strategy together, you've often got a model in mind. And we'll come to some of what some of those models are as we go through. But you've often got a model in mind. Now, if people were in the first keynote, James Bass keynote on metrics, he was talking about inquiry metrics. I'm going to put forward a piece of jargon, which I hope in that context you'll understand. An inquiry model. You've got a model in your mind of how you think you might do it, of how you think you might put this strategy together, what you think it'll look like at the end. Your inquiry model means you're going to be challenging that model, seeing whether it is truly the best model as you go through. You may have a few models and be looking at competing between those models, which is the best. So, the idea of a model goes throughout the rest of this talk. When I'm looking at test strategy, I'm often looking at trying to put something together in a reasonably straightforward way. This is the way that I think of. I try to discover a lot of information. I don't necessarily do all the analysis on it immediately, but analysis of that information helps me decide what I'm going to discover next. There's a process of feedback between discovering information and analysing that information. I've got most of my information, I'm still discovering bits and pieces, I'm going to continue to analyse it, and then I'm going to start to try to synthesise it, to try to put something together, find out information, find out what it means, get a strategy. That's how I go through. There's feedback between all of those, but there is also a general timeline. I start off by discovering things, I end up with synthesising things. What I hope not to do is discover something at the point of synthesis that means that I've synthesized the wrong things. So asking the right questions is important to me, and I'll start with that. We'll start looking at how one discovers information. Now, one of the first things to do when you're looking out for information is to try to think through the sort of things that are going to be important to you. It may be important that the test team get free pizza on Thursday nights, or it may not. It may be important that people are paid by the number of bugs they find. or it may not. And I find it useful to try to think of information in different ways. I try to think of constraints, ambitions, and philosophies. Now, constraints tend to get set externally and fairly early on. Things like, we'd like you to operate within budget. We'd like to deliver by this date. Those are constraints. We're going to have to operate within this set of requirements, within this set of restrictions. They're constraints. You tend to have those set by somebody else outside. Then you talk to a team and you find out they've not just got constraints, they've got ambitions too. They want to be faster than last time. They want to find more bugs than last time. They want to be cheaper than last time. They've got ambitions. Those are tend to be set internally. They're assessed throughout a project. Sometimes they're assessed well after a project has ended. So as you're finding information out, you'll be fitting into these various categories. And then finally, we've got philosophies. Now, there are plenty of philosophies out there, and plenty of philosophies that are out there aren't terribly well stated. We'll come to that in a moment. Let me give you some examples. If you're working in a top-down organization, managers will make a set of decisions, and the results of those will cascade down through the organization with not all that much questioning going back up. Working in a bottom-up organization, decisions tend to be made on the ground. And then the results of those decisions percolate back up. Most organizations are a mixture of both of those. But you're going to find that that changes your strategy. It gives you a context within which to work your strategy. I'm a consultant, so I tend to go into organizations that are trying to do something often revolutionary rather than evolutionary. Often I'm afraid that's revolutionary because something's gone badly wrong, or it's evolutionary because they want to completely change what they're currently doing. But I think that all these things apply to those of you who work in companies. You're going to have to still find out this stuff, still challenge your assumptions. And you may well find yourself on a more evolutionary approach. So that's something that, again, is an important consideration about the overall philosophy. Something that perhaps is talked about less is some projects are run on facts. Information is king. The information that pours out of the test team is checked, used, disseminated, acted on. Others are run on vision. The facts don't necessarily matter too much. Again, your strategy is going to be highly affected by that. So as you're discovering things, as you're making discoveries, I find it useful to be able to stick things in those buckets. This looks like an ambition, this looks like a constraint, this looks like something that I'm getting, feels like a philosophy, feels like a guiding force. That may be the strategy for the overall organisation. So that's one of the first bits in my toolbox. But here is a major tool. This tool was taught to me when I was 10. And I would like to teach it to you now. Some of you will almost certainly know it if I was taught when I was 10. My history master taught this. He went by a thoroughly obscene nickname, which I'll tell people afterwards if you choose. This is Rudyard Kipling. Rudyard Kipling said in this small poem, well, it's a very large poem, the elephant's chart, but this is a bit of it. I keep six honest serving men, they taught me all I knew. Their names are what and why and when and how and where and who. Do people recognise these six? Isn't it nice to know that they came from Kipling? I was very pleased to find that out, having been taught this. Now, people have made changes to this kind of approach over the years. These are context-free questions. And what context-free questions do is they allow you to discover more about the context you're working in, to sometimes challenge your assumptions, sometimes challenge the assumptions of those around you. But these context-free questions have been built upon. The CIA, famous, I think, have got the Phoenix List. There are Tinker Toys. Bark and Kaner have worked on a set. I basically use these. They're very short, they're very easy to remember. Personally, I've changed a couple. I tend to find that how much is an important question to ask that isn't in that lot. It's important in a commercial organisation to ask how much. I also find that why and how go well together. I stole this from an article in the back of Sticky Minds a few years ago, where I think it might have been Jerry Weinberg in the invited article was talking about how if you ask people how they expect something to matter to them, how does this matter? That's a better way of asking than saying why does this matter? You get a more practical rather than visionary output, so it's closer to the fact. So what and why and when and how and where and who? It's handy to have a set of context-free questions. It's handy to be able to go back to those, to have them always in mind, so that when you're conducting some kind of an investigation, finding out information, you've always got those to fall back. Have I actually asked all of those questions? Or where should I start? How would I expand these questions to be useful? That's my first discovery tool. My second discovery tool is to follow the decisions. I have a small illustration of somebody following a decision. They took a decision, and they're following that. He's a member of the Oxford Dangerous Sports Society, I believe. I think the danger is one is simply of fashion. Orange jumpsuits are frankly vile. However, he's following a decision. It's important that you follow the decisions. If you work in a risk-based organisation, but you find that risks are not assessed, and the findings of any risk assessment aren't disseminated, risks aren't part of decisions, then having a risk-based test strategy is something that you don't possess. That sentence didn't work, I'm very sorry. You don't have a risk-based test strategy. However much you might say you've got a risk-based test strategy, if the decisions don't bear it out, you don't have one. If your strategy is based on time to market, and many places I've worked at say our strategy is based on time to market, and yet the product slips by a week every week and a month every month, I would suggest that they have a different kind of strategy. So as you're finding information out, don't just follow what people tell you. Follow what they do. If they say they spend money, if they say that they promote learning within their testers and there's no library and no training budget, don't believe it. There is a strategy in every organisation. Every organisation has a decision-making structure. Every organisation has some underlying values. You need to follow the decisions to find out what those values are. What people tell you will not necessarily be the truth. Finally, I use these a lot in what I do, and again, whether you're working independently or more likely working in a company, I think these are absolutely vital. I like to check my facts. Those of you who've been to other talks of mine will know that sometimes I think that testing is like journalism, and independent testing is like having a free press. It's irritating, but highly important. Overall, it adds a great deal of value because of the freedom and the information that it moves around. This is a photograph of the Kirkcaldy Testing Works in London, which is a testing laboratory built in 1856, which possibly qualifies as the oldest test lab in the world. They have a 40-ton load testing machine, and for all those of you who've worked on big iron, that's the biggest iron load testing machine I've ever come across. Boom, boom. This is in their window. This is now a museum of testing, and I love this in their window. They say facts, not opinions. If I get a bunch of facts from one person after an interview, I'll write down the ones that I'm interested in and hand them back to them. I tend to try to keep it on a single sheet of paper. I tend to keep it as something that they can just write at the bottom, yeah, I agree, or scribble some notes on and say, no, I don't. And I conduct a second interview, a very short one, to say, is this right or is this not? This allows people to correct things that they said in haste. It allows you to use what they said. It allows you to believe a little bit more about what they said. So I use those three tools. Four tools, I guess, if we're thinking about the buckets. I use the context-free questions to start to find information out. I follow the decisions to dig down further. I use fact-checkers to know what's going on underneath. That gives me an idea of what the underlying strategy actually is. Whether it can be used, whether it needs changes. Changing is what we're going to do next. We're going to look at analysis. So we've discovered a lot of information. Now how do we analyse it? Well, here's a bunch of models. He says this is going to go too far forward. Never. Here's a bunch of models. Risk-based testing. I've heard about risk-based testing.
Center of your testing lies assessments of risk. Requirements-based testing. Center of your testing lies an understanding of requirements. Many more places have got a cost-based approach to testing or a time-based approach to testing. And as you analyze the information that you've got, you're going to find that these matter. Some will matter more than others. There are other things here that ought to matter. Value ought to matter. And as testers, we're missing one big one from here. Missing quality. Quality ought to matter. As you make sense of things, you're going to start using these models. You've got a model of how you think strategy perhaps ought to be. It's an inquiry model. You're going to be making some changes to that. I think we need to concentrate on cost for this part, perhaps for the whole thing. And because we're thinking about cost here, I'm not too worried about the risk. I mean, I reckon the risk is low enough for me to carry on working with cost. So you're going to make some decisions based on the model you've already got in your head. Again, we'll talk about some tools. I use a lot of graphical approaches, and I think many people do. King of the graphical approach books, as far as I can tell, and I've not read every book on strategy out there, is Jeff Coyle's book, Practical Strategy, Structured Tools and Techniques. It's handy, it's pink, and it's packed with graphical approaches. Loads of tables, loads of diagrams. Coyle's very useful for giving you diagrams. I tend to find that as I analyse things, sometimes I'll find new diagrams, new ways of looking at things. But there are some standard shapes that stuff falls into. A quadrant diagram, where you have one side that says fast things and slow things. And your columns say big things and small things. Things that are fast and big go into this quadrant. You get what I mean. You start to analyse the information that you've got. You start to look around and find out where that information actually goes with your strategy. And perhaps you'll start to find that your strategy itself is something that is communicated by these diagrams. Perhaps you're going to find out that you want to move from one element to another element. So you've got various tabulations. Maybe you want to do a lot of 9x6 cards and throw them on the floor. Maybe you want to use some kind of web-based tool. You've also got trends, scales, things you're looking at over time, things you're looking at over some dimension. This analysis tool gives you an approach that you use as you move forward to a strategy. You're also going to start to compare expectations, firstly against that model that you've got, but also perhaps against some of the things that are out there. There are a few test strategy templates. There's one in the TMAP book, the big yellow TMAP structured testing process book. That's got test strategy. IEEE 829 is often quoted to me as having a section on test strategy. It doesn't. And you'll find one on James Barth's site, which is an interesting approach to strategy. You may want to compare your strategy with various different approaches. Again, another book, Strategy Safari. This one has 10, not different strategic approaches, 10 absolutely different ways of making a strategy. It's handy to have an insight into what those could be. Big one. Oh, beg your pardon. Alan Mintzberg. And then there's two others whose first name I don't know. And Ollstrand and Lample. I'll stick it over here if you want to have a look at it later. But we also have the usual suspects. This is taken from my website. It's also taken from the foundation course, the ISET thing, ISTQB thing, and from a bunch of other sources. I don't suggest we read these right now. You may or may not want to put these into your strategy. They're important. They're useful. They're not necessary. Your strategy is a decision-making framework. You're going to use some of these, but not all of them. So we've looked at discovery and analysis. Time to spend a little bit of time with synthesis. You've already got this model in your head. Perhaps you're looking at different kinds of strategy. Perhaps you've checked out different strategies on the web. Perhaps you've looked at some checklists. You're going to have to look at some context. How big do I expect the strategy to be? Do I expect it to be understood by everybody in the organization, or do I expect it to be used by everybody in the organization? Entirely different strategies come out of that. I'll give you a salad example. I went to a restaurant on Wednesday night. I said I'd like something small and light, perhaps a salad or a bowl of soup. A salad, sir. Yes, a salad we can do for $4.50. I thought, that's fine. How big can a salad be for $4.50? Turns out it was the size of a large hat. And it was 95% lettuce. Don't let your strategy be like that salad. If your strategy is too large and 95% lettuce, it's not going to be read by many people about the place. So there are plenty of things you have to think about as you're putting that strategy together, as you're actually making it. There are some techniques that I use as I make a strategy. The first is to think of the hierarchy. What comes first? What comes second? Why you might use something in preference to something else? I think everybody will recognize this hierarchy, and I hope from that you remember hierarchy. And from that, I hope you remember the word map. There we are, map. Thursday night, trying to get people moving. So, maps and hierarchies are very useful for actually moving forwards with how you're putting your strategy together. Organizing your strategy, organizing your ideas, and putting those down. Incidentally, this is the map of the internet in 1992. And that was the royal family. Finally, I find it very useful in a testing strategy, because that's what we're talking about, is to know your techniques. I've heard people say that there is no place for techniques in a test strategy. I think techniques are vital. It's hugely important to know about the kind of bugs you're going to go out to get. Some fish you catch with a net. You might be able to catch those fish with a rod and line, but you'd get a different number of fish out in the water. You'd have to operate in a different environment. You've got different techniques for catching fish. This is particularly useless for catching trout. Don't use the wrong techniques. Techniques are important in a test strategy. I'll close that particular section by illustrating this. This is a London sport of squirrel fishing. So with a strategy, you have to know your techniques. It's testing. What are you going to do? Are you looking for value? Are you looking for bugs? Biggest first, fastest. What are you doing? That's to do with your strategy. The way you make that strategy real is to use techniques. So when you're coming into your strategy, know your techniques. So to close, some rules of thumb. I could put a conclusion up and say this is what I've already told you, but I hope that you remember some of what I told you. First rule of thumb. There is always a strategy. There is always a decision-making framework. Always. If decisions are being made, they're being made within a framework. If that framework is chaotic, it's worth recognizing that. There is always a strategy. Sitting around with your finger up your nose going, it takes too long to write a test strategy, there is already a test strategy. It's just that it hasn't necessarily been something that's been written down. Second rule of thumb. This is perverse. The bigger the subject, the smaller the strategy. If you're going to have something that runs the whole country, you probably want a very, very short strategy. If you want something that delves into the depths of doing some particular bit of testing, you might want quite a lot more information in there. I tend to find that the higher the level of strategy, the shorter it is. And I think that's an effect of how strategies are used. Strategies must be communicated. And the more people you have to communicate them to, the more general they have to be, and the shorter they have to be. So I tend to find that the broader the subject, the shorter the strategy. Finally, I've got a little note on my website that says if you want to know about test strategy, then please email me. I like to talk about test strategy, and we email back and forth, and we do the instant messaging thing and phone calls and stuff. But occasionally I get somebody who says, I'm testing a web application, what strategy should I use? I had a note from an outsourcing consulting company that were asking me for free, mind you, for a general load testing strategy for anything. At all. You can't template a strategy. You can't. Not just because I've tried and that I can't, not just because many other people have tried and I still haven't seen a good one.
I don't believe you can template a test strategy because it's unique and characteristic. It contains information about the values within your project, about the relative importance of those values. Can you template it? No. I don't think you can, but I think you can use models. I think you can use different models to come up with different parts of your strategy to assess what you're trying to do against what other people have done, to assess whether what you're finding out about the thing you're trying to make a strategy for actually fits what the strategy you believe you should have. So those are my three rules of thumb. I will finish on a brief photograph of presumably somebody winning the squirrel fishing competition. And I will thank you all very much for your attention. I think we have about 10 minutes left for questions. Right, well, 13 minutes for questions, which means about 4.5 seconds for every single one of you.
Questions you like?
Come on, he's got nice knees, making them up and down for him.
No questions. Oh, there's one. Sir.
You're the first man who's asked me questions ever stood up. Thank you.
When you are in contact with your customers, how many organizations do actually have a strategy that spans the whole development chain from product management out to end of life cycle for product?
That's a difficult question because I've just said that every organization has a strategy and there is a strategy everywhere. They all have one. Can I paraphrase that and say how many organizations got an explicit written strategy? Is that a good paraphrase? Yeah? Okay. Not many. And they tend to fall into two camps. Very, very small. And very, very large. Very small groups have got a strategy that goes all the way through, mainly because it's the same people. And they can communicate it, and often they've written it down, it's fairly quick. Sometimes the strategy in an organization like that is, we've got Kent Beck's book. That's their strategy. And that is their decision-making process. They follow the book. Slightly larger organizations might use the big yellow TMAP book. Very, very large organizations, and I've been involved with a few, not a massive number. And by that, I mean very large informations like IBM. Not very large organizations that don't have an in-house development process. They tend to have one, but it tends to be not known by everybody within the organization. So I'm not convinced it works. Yes, sir.
For those of you leaving, please remember to fill out the little green forms and hand them out in the door. Thank you.
How would you suggest starting a strategy development workout? Would you involve the whole team, or would you select a few individuals, or would you just leave that to the top management?
I typically wouldn't leave a strategic, formulating a strategy to top management, although they often feel that that's what they do. I think that there are certain skills and strategy that are involved in making one that aren't necessarily always part of top management skills. Finding out information, I talk to as many people as I possibly can, and if there are too many people, I'll try to take a representative sample. And I'll take a representative sample as broadly as possible. That's my approach. I've seen very good results from workshops of up to 12. If you've got more than 12, it's hard to run a workshop anyway. Does that answer your question? A bit vague. Okay.
Any other questions?
Oh, I'm here. Okay.
How long does it take to formulate a strategy? What percentage of time? Or do you have any rules of thumb?
Or any question? I don't have any rules of thumb. I probably ought to, shouldn't I? For a particularly large project, and I say, I tend to have very brief strategies. And they take a lot of time to discover and very little time to write. In that case, it would probably take me maybe a week to 2 weeks worth of going around and asking questions, and maybe a few days worth of analysis and writing. But I qualify that by saying that that strategy probably wouldn't be the finished article at all. That'd be something which would act as a seed for the organization then take on and see if that is truly their strategy and a genuine reflection of their values and something they want to take forward. Something smaller, I might well write as I go, and it would take a few weeks. I would hope that, with the agility of the world being as it is, it wouldn't ever take me more than a month to write a strategy of an appropriate size. But again, I'm not sure that would be the finish line for me. Anybody else? I can't answer that question.
Hello. My question is, we're one of those organizations that has a strategy that's not official, it's not written down, and I'm sure if I try to write one the first time, it's going to be wrong.
Yeah.
So is it more damaging to take your best guess and have it wrong and have to do it over, or is it better to take the time to really make sure that you're closer to right the first time?
My personal approach?
Yeah.
I write a very, very, very short strategy. Very quick. Few lines based on a few conversations, and that'll be my starter. Sometimes that'll immediately come back with a no. More often that'll come back with a yeah, kind of. So in the same way that one might do a piece of development, you might look for immediate value in the very short term and keep on trying to find that value to get better and better. But if you're in an organization that seems to have a strategy and is making consistent decisions, so it's not a chaotic strategy, then that's a great position to be in, because you can start to write these things down in crystal.
Any other questions? Anybody?
How is a test strategy different from a test process?
A lot of people use test methodology and test process books as their test strategy. I would say that typically test methodology and test process is too detailed to be a strategy. It contains a lot of information about what you do rather than why you do it. It doesn't contain all that much information about why you would make a certain set of decisions. And what that means is the strategy isn't resilient to change. Strategy should not be resistant to change. A lot of methodologies and written down processes are. But a strategy is resilient to change. A lot of processes and methodologies are not. Does that answer your question?
Anyone else? Yes.
So I just say, Ringo is asking loads of questions right now.
Ringo rocks, let me tell you.
Yeah.
In a large global organization where you have multiple segments all doing testing validation work, would you advocate a global test strategy for all those entities, or more of a compartmentalized test strategy for each segment or something?
Well, that sounds suspiciously close to a templating question. If the values are shared across a company, then yes, you can write a shared strategy. Indeed, you can use a shared strategy to promote those values across the organization. But if the values aren't shared, no, a shared strategy would be the wrong idea. Is that sensible?
Anybody else? Going once? Going twice? Okay, James, you're off the hook.
Lovely, excellent.